The original guide to men's health is moving to a monthly release schedule. We will be releasing new episodes the first Wednesday of each month. We really appreciate you listening, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. Welcome to The Original Guide to Men's Health, a podcast designed for men of all ages to learn about and access good health. This guide shares knowledge on how to be and stay healthy, maintenance and prevention strategies, along with reviews of conditions and issues affecting wellness are explored. Please join me, your host, Dr. Richard Pellman, as I interview renowned experts who will provide you with timely, relevant, and vital information so that you can embark on a journey towards better health. On this episode of The Original Guide to Men's Health, we will be exploring healthcare equity. Specifically, we'll be exploring racism and its impact and bias in healthcare delivery. We will be convening a panel of experts. Joining me today are a guest for our panel, Dr. Bessie Young, MD, MPH, Professor, Division of Nephrology, Medical Director, and Associate Dean for Healthcare Equity, the University of Washington. Dr. Young completed medical school at the University of Washington, her medical residency at the University of Washington. She served as Chief Medical Resident at the University of Washington. She completed her nephrology fellowship at the University of Washington, and she served as General Internal Medicine Fellow at the VA and Puget Sound Healthcare System. Dr. Young received her Master's of Public Health Epidemiology from the University of Washington. Dr. Young is currently sharing national responsibilities for the Dean's Standing Committee on Minority Faculty Affairs, the NIH-NIDDK Network of Minority Research Investigators Oversight Committee. She serves on the editorial board, Current Diabetes Reviews, and the editorial board for the Journal of American Society of Nephrology, and the Clinical Journal of the American Society of Nephrology. Dr. Leo Morales, MD, PhD. He is professor and assistant dean for the Office of Healthcare Equity, School of Medicine, and adjunct professor of public health. Leo Morales is a professor of medicine and assistant dean with the Office for Healthcare Equity and co-director of the Latino Center for Health at the University of Washington. Dr. Morales received his medical degree and master's degree in public health from the University of Washington and his doctorate in policy analysis from the Rand Graduate School. He completed a residency in primary care internal medicine at the San Francisco General Hospital, UCSF, and a fellowship in primary care research at UCLA. Dr. Morales' research focuses on Latino health, racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic disparities in health, and the measurement of patient-reported outcomes in diverse communities. Also joining me today is Dr. Eugene Rhee, MD, MBA. Dr. Rhee is the Regional Chief of Urology for Kaiser Permanente in Southern California and the National Chair of Urology for the Permanente Federation. He also serves as the Area Assistant Medical Director for the Business Line and Finance for Kaiser Permanente in San Diego. Dr. Rhee earned his medical degree from Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia, and he completed his residency at the Kaiser Permanente Foundation Hospitals in Los Angeles, California. He received both his Bachelor of Science in Biology and his Bachelor of Arts in Political Science from Emory University. He received his MBA from the Anderson School of Management at UCLA and is a graduate of the 2010-11 AUA Leadership Class. Dr. Rhee serves as chair of the Public Policy Council for the American Urologic Association. He was the 2013-14 AUA Gallagher Health Policy Scholar. He's a past president of California Urologic Association and the San Diego Urologic Society. So for this episode on health equities, we have an expert panel that I previously introduced, and we're going to be exploring a number of issues. Let's start with exploring racism and its impact and bias in health for healthcare delivery, for the population, for caregivers. Dr. Eugene Rhee, you're first.
I really appreciate Dr. Pillman getting us together in terms of a very pertinent topic as it regards to health equities across the country. I took on a role for public policy as a chair of the American Urologic Association. And there's definitely, we're certainly in combination with a lot of things that's happened to us in the country, obviously a pandemic along with the social unrest that's occurred in the George Floyd incident, as well as frankly, the presidential election. These things have really kind of come together to really have us come to a pause and look where we are as a country. That being said, people on this panel as healthcare, because of the pandemic, there's a lot of attention towards the work that we do as physicians and nurses and administrators, as far as that's concerned, to deliver the care. And I think this is our opportunity. So I'll start off by saying that this podcast, I think, is a wonderful opportunity, a venue, if you will, to create thoughts with those who are listening and a broad audience and really understand how we can really take the opportunity to affect change. So that being said, one of the things that I've noticed, so I work at Kaiser Permanente, and it's the largest healthcare organization as a health maintenance organization in the country, serving 11.7 million lives. There are for sure issues in regards to healthcare inequities that we are addressing as an organization. So I'm an administrator in that organization as well. And tying in urologic care, I'm a urologist by trade, but really tying in the things that are involving urology care to the fact that we serve so many lives. The typical, most of our patients come from actually large employer groups. And in other words, those who come from large companies and that sort of thing, as an example. Those patients, you know, it's the traditional model from the FDR days where the employer would carry the insurance. We are not seeing that now, a trend that's moving towards having the employee carry a lot of that cost. And where we're seeing a shift certainly is the profile of the patients that are really being able, in terms of affordable healthcare. And I think what we're definitely seeing is, for sure, the lower socioeconomic status of our patients. We're seeing a drop that's considerable over time as far as that's concerned. I'm in California, the Medi-Cal or Medicaid population, if you will. There is definitely a broad shift that's occurring where they're dropping off even the exchanges or large employer groups or small employer groups and moving over now to Medi-Cal. And the Biden administration, I think, hopefully, because he was vice president at the time that Obama was the president who passed the ACA, the administration is really talking about is continuing the ACA. And I think that that's really a good measure because of the broad spectrum of offering subsidies in this lower socioeconomic class to create access to care in the population that otherwise wouldn't have it. So my reflection on this, just from a standpoint of a macro level of what, you know, we're managing it at our big institution, as well as in the space of the AUA, the American Urologic Association, and healthcare public policy kind of movement, we're definitely trying to create access to care, particularly in urology, where it's much needed in the high-risk population, such as the African Americans. So
I think that this pandemic and COVID has illuminated the holes in the fabric of what we call healthcare. And the reality is, though, that those holes were present before the pandemic. Some of those holes are quite large and have left out individuals for some time. So, Dr. Young, I'll ask you for information that you'd like to contribute along those lines.
So thank you for having me. And I think you're right. So the pandemic really has exposed some of the big holes in our healthcare system and shows where our social determinants of health are really what are contributing to the folks who are getting COVID, have got COVID, have not survived through this whole COVID pandemic. And it's really those social determinants of health that really sort of are the larger risk factors for poor healthcare. And I think, you know, most of the essential workers and who's at the highest risk for COVID, it sort of falls disproportionately on communities of color. So Black communities, Pacific Islander, in our area here in the Pacific Northwest, Hispanic and Latinx are the communities that were most affected by COVID. And those communities have higher risk of disease, morbidity, mortality, death from COVID. So, you know, racism has a lot to do with our whole healthcare system and access to care. And there are just a lot of sort of holes in our system that we need to really sort of try to fix. The Affordable Care Act helped people get access to care. And that's what people need. You know, they need access to primary care providers so that they can get their hypertension treated, they can get their diabetes treatment, they can get diagnosed with diseases that they might not otherwise get diagnosed with, so that if they do get other diseases like COVID, then they're at a lower risk of, you know, having poor outcomes from obtaining disease.
So we'll dive more deeply. I'll hear from Dr. Morales, and then we'll come back, because we do really want to drill down on some specifics here. Dr. Morales.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me on your podcast. And I guess I'll just start by echoing what Dr. Young just said, that, you know, the pandemic really has shown the holes in our healthcare system. But I also just want to state clearly that I believe racism has a direct effect on people's health and accounts for health disparities that we observe among and differences between white and communities of color, both directly and indirectly. So we know there's a growing body of evidence about the effect of racism on individuals, that bias, when they face bias and discrimination in their work life or in society, has direct effects on health. And also that racism has operated through policies and practices over the history of this country that have resulted in these disparities in social determinants of health. So we have a lot more segregation in our cities than we're aware of. And that segregation affects where people live, the kinds of resources they have access to, issues of housing, issues of access to transportation, healthy foods, and built environments that support health. So all of these various ways in which the history of race and racism in this country do and continue to impact health. So I think it's very pervasive and a very important public health issue.
I completely agree with Dr. Morales, like the history of redlining, where certain individuals from, you know, either African-American or other BIPOC communities were not allowed to buy houses in certain areas, and it was deeded into the property. And so you have concentrations of people in certain areas of the city, which when we look at those areas now are really concentrations of people who have poor access to care, and really show that there's like increased morbidity and mortality from lots of different diseases. So these were systems that were set up, you know, back in the 20s and 30s in many of our major cities that are still on the books in some places, that really contribute to sort of the systemic racism that's sort of gone on and has really sort of ingrained it in how we live and where we live. And that can affect, you know, whether or not people have access to education. Do they have the ability to generate wealth in their families and sort of give that to their children, which can affect lots of areas of health and healthcare?
Yeah, I think many studies have demonstrated that your state of health is really determined by your zip code, something that's gone on for years and years. Again, the pandemic just highlighted everything, but this is a issue that we're trying to address. The impact isn't just for people in the populations who are seeking care or in need of care, but racism all extends to caregivers too. So we can talk a little bit for the listening audience about that. You know, we have pretty much for years had a homogeneous population of caregivers, and people of color were very underrepresented. And the populations seeking care were, of course, looking at the person who's giving care, and they're different. So let's talk a little bit about the importance now of improving caregivers' sort of ability to recognize racism and what they need to do and to improve their ability to give care.
So we know from research that cultural and linguistic concordance between patients and providers results in better care for patients of color. That happens because with concordance comes more trust. And as a result, people are more likely to follow the recommendations of their doctor. They're more likely to follow up care as requested. And so you see the results in terms of better outcomes. The second factor is that providers of color are much more likely to practice in communities of color. And so that reduces some of the access barriers that people of color who live in their communities just don't have clinics, don't have access to doctors. And finally, I was going to just mention then, if you are basically in the situation we're in now, which is we don't have diversity among our providers, we need to better prepare doctors to work in communities of color. So that means having a curriculum that prepares medical students and trainees for working in communities of color, gives them tools, and also gives them insight as to what may be some of those unexamined factors that are influencing the kind of care they deliver. Commonly, people talk about implicit bias as being one of those issues.
What do you see as a ways and means of helping to get people who still are disenfranchised with the system back into care, besides having more physicians or caregivers of color? How do we improve access to the populations?
So I was just thinking about the situation we're in with COVID and the vaccines in particular. So vaccines are free, and yet we see disparities in vaccine uptake. So what are the issues at work there? So there's still a concern of paying for vaccines. There's a recent survey that showed that more than half of Latinos who are unvaccinated believe they have to pay. Financial concerns are clearly an issue, even when, and that also happens in insured populations. You still see disparities in access, even though everyone's insured under a common plan like Kaiser. The second thing is they have concerns around, at least with the immigrant population, they have concerns about impacts on their future immigration status. So there's fear. They don't typically come to institutions that require divulging a lot of information about themselves because they themselves may be undocumented or they may have undocumented people in their family who they want to protect. So they avoid situations where they may be asked to provide documentation. And there are these other costs that are associated that are unaddressed, like taking time off from work. We don't tend to think about that much, but for people who live paycheck to paycheck or day to day as day laborers or have very low income, low wage jobs, missing a day to go get vaccinated, maybe missing a day due to side effects are real costs that they consider. Even though the vaccine itself is free, that goes to larger issues around how we support our families and parents and mothers who have to, you know, who are the primary caregivers for their children, and how do we make it possible for them to take care of themselves? So those are just a few issues in terms of helping connect people better to the healthcare system.
That extends beyond just vaccination. You know, somebody coming for a regular clinic visit may not have transportation, have to ride public transportation. It may be 3 hours of riding public transportation. And then, you know, the way our system works is we get initial evaluation, then we have further testing. That's yet another trip and another day off. And somebody just goes, I just can't do it. That's just the reality for a lot of people, that they can't afford the time off. Or for somebody who has little ones at home and can't have somebody else come in, what do you do?
And people, you know, sometimes they can't afford their medication. So they may have hypertension or diabetes, and they have medications that they're supposed to be taking, but they have to decide between taking their medication and whether or not they're going to eat or feed their family. So those are real issues that people do have to deal with. And sometimes they don't tell that to their provider. So a lot of times, you know, someone may have some issue where they either can't take a medication or don't necessarily trust what the physician is saying. And so the physician thinks they're ramping up a medication because someone's blood pressure may not be controlled, but really the patient hadn't been taking the medication because they didn't believe what the physician or the provider was telling them, or they didn't have, you know, access to that medication because it was just too costly. And so a lot of times patients may be seen or they are told that they're not compliant, but really we as physicians haven't done a good job with sort of interacting with our patients, one, to gain trust, to figure out what are the other social determinants of health that might be affecting whether or not they can want to afford a medication and how they take it, and then sort of really helping them to deal with their own health issues within their environment.
I think that's really key, is not to make an assumption that all patients are going to really feel comfortable necessarily taking what the physician or the care provider prescribes or dictates. I think the issue is really understanding and spending time with your patients, understanding their background and asking if there's concerns and explaining. You know, education goes a long way. I think most of my patients, if I spent the time explaining why, are agreeable. But I would never make an assumption. And yet there's lots of assumptions that occur. I'll get back to care delivery because I'd like to talk about our public health system, which could be more robust. Again, the pandemic showed some deficiencies in the public health system. We have Dr. Reback online. And as someone involved in a large healthcare delivery system, how do you take care of a population that, you know, has been underrepresented by caregivers who come into a system, who may not have direct access to a clinic and may not feel comfortable coming into healthcare?
I'll give you a great illustrative example. Screening colonoscopies is really underserved in the Hispanic population. And in Southern California, close to the border, Southern San Diego, we just had a meeting a couple of months ago looking at some numbers to show that the Hispanic population is underserved. Therefore, we're diverting our resources from the North County in order to move colonoscopy screening and as well the communication to the patients that actually live in the South County, most of who are Hispanic. Point of the story is also, you know, being sensitive to the reasons, you know, from a cultural standpoint as to why people actually don't seek healthcare. They're afraid, or there's even issues in certain ethnic populations where, you know, even being told they have cancer is not told to them. That's a very culturally sensitive thing, even though in our context of federal law to say it's, you know, the relationship and the information you exchange between you and the patient actually goes in direct conflict with culturally what some of the ethnic populations are dealing with. So, you know, going back to colonoscopies, you know, we have to be sensitive to how we communicate. So we have Hispanic leaders in our organization, which type of communication, how it's going to be communicated in regards to providing the ability for them to be even aware that we, you know, colonoscopy is encouraged, and how do we actually communicate the appointments and diverting those resources. But again, it's really the communities we serve. And I think that being sensitive to that from the mission statement is extremely important. I think we do lead in, as far as organization concerned, in regards to trying to be all inclusive in our care that we deliver, no matter where you're from. So that's sort of our mantra, if you will, in our organization.
Your organization is huge, and you do have the ability to scrub data across the organization. So are there people actively looking at this within Kaiser Permanente?
Oh, yeah. There's a sense of mission, again, in regards to the communities that are being served. So in Los Angeles during the pandemic, it was very clear the Hispanic population was a lot of those that were infected. Point of the story is, you know, the families tend to be tight knit. They tend to be in homes that are in close proximity to each other, extended families, large families.
Yes, large families, multi-generational homes. And so a lot of the spread that was happening in Latino communities, both in Los Angeles and really all along the West Coast, was because of the way people are living, housing, their housing and their housing situations. So a lot of transmission within homes, within families.
We have Dr. Ree with Kaiser, and both you, Dr. Morales, and Dr. Young are with the University of Washington Institution. We also have a lot of still private practitioners and private offices. We are seeing a shift. I think for the first time, more medical students and residents going into residency, and then residents graduating are going into an employed situation rather than a private practice. That is flipped as to what's previously occurred. But we still have a significant part of the population in a private setting, and how do we get our population into the private sector?
A lot of that, you know, in terms of subsidizing those in, you know, those who can't afford the care, we have to have payment parity and reimbursement for covering the cost of things in terms of that. But there also has to be some form of, you know, work where in the private sector that you're able to donate time, the effort, you know, that sort of thing as well. Certainly this administration moving forward, I think, are looking at things through the Affordable Care Act in just that way, right? In regards to Medi-Cal, Medicaid. I do believe that otherwise what happened last year, previous administration, was to each his own. The states were up to this in terms of funding. I think there's got to be a collection of state and federal funding in order to subsidize, and there has to be also some form of tax credit or something like that nature in order for, you know, the independent practices to offer care that makes sense in terms of their business.
Dr. Young?
I agree with that. I think there are institutions, so like the University of Washington, thinking about the COVID situation, when we found out that there were pockets of people who weren't getting vaccines, we actually tried to ramp up, you know, vaccines and ramped up pop-up clinics and ramped up our mobile outreach so that we could actually target those folks who weren't getting taken care of by other institutions or, you know, private insurance. And when testing was done, then we switched those into actually like giving people vaccines. And that's what we're doing now. So I think not everybody can have private insurance. We have to come together somehow to make sure that people are covered in lots of different healthcare systems. I formerly worked at the VA where, you know, we offered care to anyone who was a veteran, and there were lots of services that were available. And it was just really trying to get people to come to the VA to get those services. And when, you know, we started to ramp up for when COVID hit, the VA really did ramp up services for one, testing and then giving vaccines to veterans and to their families. So I think it can be done, and sometimes it's done outside of the system, but something that systems actually can do in response to these sort of emergencies and pandemics.
Dr. Morales?
The ACA is a great first step. It's covered a lot of people. We need to continue to expand insurance coverage and then also payment parity. So we're not building two-tiered or three-tiered systems where providers providing care to certain segments of the patient population are getting reimbursed at a much lower rate than others.
Again, the pandemic has illuminated a hole in that fabric of healthcare delivery that was public health. And I would suggest that beefing up the public health system would be wonderful. I'm going to just throw out something. The former chair of urology at Oregon Health Sciences, Dr. John Berry, had proposed a solution for a medical student who had taken loans to do, after medical school, 1 year of public health service, and they would have loan forgiveness. And yes, we could establish some clinics for the students to go into, and there'd be supervision, so it's sort of like be an internship, but a clinic internship, or maybe even in the hospital. As you all know, in Seattle, we used to have a public health hospital, and maybe it's time to go back to a more robust public health system. Thoughts on that?
So I've been looking at the COVID situation in our state across counties, and it's amazing how much variation there is. King County is almost as well funded or maybe better funded than the State Department of Health because of all the contracts and grants it brings in. And yet counties where there was a lot of problems, you know, Central Washington counties, Chelan, Okanagan, Yakima, were really struggling. They have two or three people trying to do the work of a really what should be a department. It's tragic.
I think it starts with a step that, you know, what we've experienced with a year and a half and why we're all on Zoom in the first place is how do we leverage digital technology to access the underserved in ways that make sense as a first great step, a broad footprint. So for example, in urologic care, 60% of US counties don't have a urologist to practice in that county to serve. So, you know, a good first step is how do you actually have urologists serve counties that are completely underserved, rural areas, areas of Indian Health Services, pockets where completely there is no urologist. So as an example, telemedicine in this specialty care is here to stay. The traditional model of, okay, well, the loan forgiveness that's well and good, and we can do that. But how do we carry that one step further? And it's still not enough. You need to have a broader footprint than just a few hundred, you know, in the fleet of folks who are joining a medical corps. You have to actually have, how do you deliver the care now in areas to serve? And then the that's why the telemedicine aspect of this is so fascinating. And it's actually so important now in regards to public health emergency that allows us now to do this kind of interaction. It's key to deliver healthcare as well. So, you know, to answer your question, Richard, there's an opportunity here in regards to digital technology to really provide access to care for those who don't have it.
And I would agree with that. I think as a country, though, we have to say that we are going to fund healthcare. We're going to fund primary care. Because if we do that, then we can actually decrease a lot of the complications that occur. And as a nephrologist, you know, we as a country said we would fund dialysis. So if somebody develops kidney failure, we will take care of you. We will pay for most of it. But you basically have to fail just primary health care. And so we don't prevent disease when we could. And I think that's what we as a country have to agree to. You know, the ACA started it, but we as a country have to agree that we are going to fund primary care and fund health care so that we can prevent a lot of the complications that occur. And if we do that, then we can decrease, you know, people going on dialysis and people dying from not getting screened for colorectal cancer and, you know, women having mastectomies because of breast cancer. It's just, those things need to be done. We know how to treat them. We have the medicine. You know, it's not something really that's rocket science. We know how to treat that sort of thing. We just have to diagnose it and get people treated. And I think that that's something that we have to agree to do as a country.
I wanted to just chime in on the telehealth as an opportunity. And I do agree. I think it is an opportunity to bring more people into care. But our healthcare system, UW Medicine, I think went from something like 300 to 20,000 healthcare visits via telemedicine in a period of about 3 months. But what we've also seen is that there are huge disparities in who's using the telehealth. So, you know, if we're going to make this intervention to improve equity, we really need to figure out how to reach those folks that are not currently accessing telehealth. And there are just huge differences in terms of education and race ethnicity.
Great point, Dr. Morales. From our system, we've, you know, audio visits only is been something we've always done as a prepaid health plan, and we've continued to support. Video visits, as you know, video is really reliant on broadband access, and that's where the rubber meets the road. And I do believe that what's happening now is a lot of large medical organizations are pushing, trying to get audio visits accepted on a permanent level. It's a big challenge, but CMS is interested in hearing through providers about what is it about audio visits. Of course, on the other side is they are worried, and Dr. Young, you're talking about, you know, primary care. I think the concern for many in the government or as payers are that, you know, how do you measure, how do you actually measure quality and that sort of thing. From our standpoint as physicians, broadband access is only for those who can afford it. Bottom line. And so, you know, until you have a national, you know, broadband access, you know, that breaking up AT&T and Verizon as an example, these are, I don't know, you know, whether that's even feasible, but there is major discussion either providing broadband or, you know, trying to make audio visits inclusive in regards to telemedicine encounters.
Yeah, I think that's a key point. As we've seen, we've had freezing here. So a lot of our patients have difficulty with the video and the visit turns into audio. And we certainly want parity for that. It's still office overhead, office time, everything's in place. And if it turns into an audio visit, it shouldn't be a determiner for reimbursement. I want to go back to some of what we've touched on. I look at individuals who may not currently have been into care, dropped out, lost jobs as a result of pandemic, given up coverage. They may be listening and saying, well, what do I do? How do I get in? What should I do? And so I'm going to ask that as the first question. Just taking individuals out there who isn't being seen, where should they go? What should they do? What are their resources? And then two, to talk about various populations for populations of color, as far as mortality and morbidities that we see within the Hispanic, within the Asian, within the Black community. So I'll start with Dr. Morales. You know, an individual right now who's listening, who isn't in the system, what can they do?
Well, I think the first step is get coverage. And so looking to the state for subsidized programs, either, you know, through ACA or state-sponsored programs, Medicaid expansion programs. I think that's the first step, because otherwise healthcare is just unaffordable. There are sliding fee scale community health centers. That's another option. No person should be turned away from a community health center for lack of ability to pay. That doesn't mean that people don't pay anything. They try to make it accessible and reasonable. But I think some people still have those concerns around cost. So I would say those are the two ways I would go. One is to try to find insurance through a public sponsored program. And then certainly if you happen to be located near community health centers, they are a fine option for subsidized care.
Dr. Young?
I don't think I have anything to add to that. I think there are federally funded health systems and clinics out there that people can go to, and really trying to get insurance if one can. Going to an emergency room if you have an emergency is something that people do, but trying to find and get a primary care provider is something that, you know, would be optimal.
Dr. Ree, as far as Kaiser and getting somebody in who doesn't have Kaiser coverage, what happens there?
To Dr. Morales' point, I mean, the California Exchange is where we, you know, the folks have, we're noticing they're going to. Biden had done the American Rescue Plan, that whole $1.9 trillion ask that he passed. I think he signed it into law in March. Part of that bulk of that money is to reinforce the state exchanges and also subsidies for Medi-Cal and Medicaid. At the end of the day, you know, a family of four, it's a big lift. It's a big expense in regards to medical coverage. And so the point is finding subsidized health insurance is really the way to go. Otherwise, it's just a shame, because we're the only, as a country, that we're so advanced that we can't even offer catastrophic insurance across the board for everybody in this country. I mean, we're not talking high-end plan. We're talking just a basic element plan. And I think that's really shameful, right, to be honest with you. The insurance companies, you know, we've not been able to offer just a basic health insurance for everybody who in this country is just astounding to me. When you go to other countries and see, they even cover, you know, if you're visiting the country of, you know, Sweden, you're covered, you know, for catastrophic if you get hit by a car. Those are the things that I think we as a country, you know, need to figure out. The Affordable Care Act is the closest we've ever come, and it barely passed. One vote. I mean, President Obama should be credited for the vision he did and the heavy lift that required. That's the one thing that I think Biden we'll see in the future, you know, is more of the Affordable Care Act. He certainly has signed a lot of executive orders in support of that. I think for the Kaiser Permanente, this organization is a large organization. I think that there are financial counselors that work with those who just lost their insurance to transition and find them options as counselors. That's what's happened, because we've lost members for sure over this time period. And the exchange has been a great depot to look at for resources.
Just addressing within communities of color, leading morbidities and causes of mortality, and what we can do as far as encouraging screening, Dr. Morales?
At least for Latino men, the leading cause of death is heart disease, followed by cancer, followed by unintentional injuries or accidents, stroke, diabetes, chronic liver disease, homicide, and Alzheimer's disease. Those are the top 10 causes of mortality among Latinos, Latino men. Surprisingly and paradoxically, Latino men and women tend to have lower mortality rates than expected. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And sometimes it's referred to as the Hispanic health paradox, but there's a lot of heterogeneity within the Latino community, Latino population in the country. And so you have to be a little cautious when you talk about mortality rates among Latinos, because they vary quite a bit depending on who you're talking about.
Dr. Young?
For Black men, the number one cause of death is heart disease, followed by cancer, and then unintentional injuries, and then homicide, stroke, and then diabetes. So, you know, heart disease is something that could definitely be evaluated, and we could, you know, treat hypertension, cancer. I think there's this big difference in colorectal cancer and colorectal cancer screening for African Americans. And so that's something that needs to be done. And there are easy tests to do that. So there's, you know, like the FIT stool test that can be done. And then if something's positive, people can get a colonoscopy. So really getting people to do sort of these easy tests is something that we're, you know, really trying to focus in as a healthcare system.
Calling on a urologist for morbidity, mortality statistics. I don't want to put Dr. Rhee on the spot, but for the Asian community, if you have any data.
The Asian American population, there's a lot of cancer GI. The way in terms of screening is concerned, it's really how we've been very diligent with identifying high-risk populations and then working on preventive care. So, you know, Kaiser Permanente has a strong primary care presence, and with that comes the communication and the education to tap into it. So our resources from that are basically, you know, screening, for example, colonoscopy is a big one as far as that's concerned. Prostate cancer is very low on our list in terms of the Asian American population. So that's not been a real big issue from a, you know, from that standpoint, African American for sure.
And as we're closing out on time, I think everybody on the panel is involved in medical student education. So just to go over what we're doing to improve awareness for our medical students and the pathways we're developing, Dr. Morales, I'll start there.
Well, first I'll say, in many cases, students are teaching us. Our students are more diverse than they have been in the past. They're better prepared. They come in very aware, and many of them are activists in their own rights. And so I think in many ways they're driving change. And we're responding to that demand for change by providing a different kind of curriculum. So I think the curriculum now includes a lot more about population health. At UW, we have specific pathways for different population groups. So we have a pathway on Latino health. We have a pathway on LGBTQ health, one on Indian health, and there's one being developed on African-American health. And we have a whole lot of service learning opportunities. So these are opportunities for students to get out into communities in various ways much sooner than they would otherwise. And finally, I'll mention, we have rural health opportunities as well. Because we are a large rural region, you know, we recruit, train, and then place medical students in rural health settings.
Dr. Young?
I agree with everything that Dr. Morales has said. We do have these pathways at the University of Washington, and we are really learning from our students. Our students are really pushing us to develop these new sort of outreach to different communities that have typically been underserved. And just in terms of the Black health justice pathway that Dr. Morales mentioned, that was really started from the ground up by student activists who said, this is something that we need in our curriculum. And they pushed it. And finally, this year, it's actually going to come to fruition. So it's a pathway that hadn't really been, that the UW didn't have in the past. So, you know, as sort of people who've been around academia for a long time, we are learning from the students. The students are pushing us to change and to be more inclusive. We need to reach out to different communities to make sure that we are, you know, partnering with the communities, because otherwise we'll continue the same way that we have been and people will remain underserved. So
thank you. And Dr. Rhee?
Kaiser Permanente has a medical school started last year during the COVID, I might add. But, you know, the stance on the medical school is called the Bernard Tyson School of Medicine, named after the CEO of Kaiser Permanente in his vision. Sadly, Bernard Tyson passed away, African-American in San Francisco, a very well-respected healthcare executive. Be that as it may, his vision aligns with the medical group and the physicians to provide a broader picture of health graduate medical education. So the focus of the medical school class is for the under-resourced, underserved, culturally diverse. The makeup of the class reflects that. Faculty reflects that. And I think that moving forward, it has an integrated sort of curriculum that is very unique in a case-based type of picture, very much a small group approach. And I think this class of medical students, as they continue to move forward in our system, will really be exposed to a lot of population health, preventive care, the value of that. And so the design of this is, our hope is that the graduates of the class, regardless of what specialty or primary care they go to, that they will be leaders in their own right in providing care that is really culturally diverse.
So appreciate the students and the residents. They're so energizing. But I also give credit to the institutions for taking their cue. And, you know, we see that that's evolved and will continue to evolve. In closing up, I always like to ask for any resources that you may have particular for the communities.
Well, I think good sources of information on health of minority populations is available through, I go to the CDC. CDC has lots of good information available. There's the Office for Minority Health, which is a federal government office. And there's the National Institute for Minority Health and Health Disparities at NIH. It also has information, not so much consumer information, that would be more oriented towards other faculty, perhaps.
I agree with those great resources, and sometimes local departments of health. So for us, Seattle King County actually has lots of information, and it's sort of the go-to place for if you want information like on COVID and just, you know, what are the numbers and where to go. So the local departments of health are usually good sources as well.
I think the best source, to be honest with you, are your first generation folks. So for example, in the Asian American population, those who came here as immigrants to the United States during the time where the 1970s and 60s, during the civil rights era, I think it's a really valuable first person experience to ask. So in other words, asking your mother or father about what it was like to come from overseas to a new country and the hopes and dreams and why did you come? And then how did that change? I think is very effective to hear the struggles, the real struggles that they went through. So my parents are Korean and they came over after the Korean War. So MASH was the number one show in the 1970s. My father and mother really resented the fact, particularly my father, the stereotype that was depicted about the Koreans. I think over time, the first person narrative, his story, really affected me in regards to how I would handle all the racism that occurred living in the Deep South as a child. And it was immense. I think that that's invaluable. And as doctors, here's the one thing that you have access to. You have access to patients who are of that generation. It could be a World War II veteran for that. You know, they're in their 80s now. They're still living examples. I was just talking to a Hungarian Jew, and she is 83. She was 8 years old when the Nazis came through Holland and bombed her town, took her cousins and older men away. It's extraordinary, the stories and how they lived through it and worked through all that and become very successful in life in their own right today. Those are very powerful. I don't know if you get that from a website, you get it through patients. I feel very honored and grateful to be able to have that access to folks who trust me as a physician. But on the other hand, you ask them, what was it like? And so, you know, if it's not your parents, it's certainly your patients.
A very personal voice in seeking information.
Yeah, I'm moved by what Dr. Reed just said, and I think that's so true. For somebody who's a physician who's listening to this, talk to your, you know, people you work with, organize yourselves, talk to patients, talk to community members in your own local neighborhood, in your own local community. And that's a way to learn and also to make a change.
I agree. I think we need to partner, listen to our communities, partner with our communities, because I think as physicians, you know, we don't hear that voice. As healthcare systems, we don't hear that voice, and it's so important.
Well, on that, I want to be respectful of all your times. You are the busiest of people, and I am so grateful that you've taken the time to contribute, and I thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Dr. Bowman.
Thank you.
This completes another episode of the Original Guide to Men's Health podcast. We wish to thank all guests who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The show's recordings are engineered and edited by Sean Fox. Episode titles and descriptions, as well as editing assistance, are provided by Dr. Kathleen O'Connor, PhD. Music for our show is San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. David Weidig. The podcast is sponsored and published by the Washington State Urology Society. The Original Guide to Men's Health is an original publication of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the expressed or written consent of the Society is prohibited. For more information about men's health and previous episodes, as well as additional recommended resources, visit us online at theoriginalguidetomenshealth.com. This is Dr. Richard Pellman thanking you for listening and reminding you to take care of yourself.